Anyway, I'm the only one who can make this thing operate. You see, there's a leg missing. How do you like your coffee?
Alone. I said let go.
That's right. Be afraid of me. A little afraid, at least. A woman's no good to a man unless she's a little afraid of him. Come.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much, Michael H. Price, and I'm happy to be here with you and to be introducing. You seem to have a new book every time we do a podcast, Michael.
We just don't know when to quit.
Well, we don't know when to quit. We're going to do it until we get it right, I know, and I know you feel the same way I do. But the latest thing you've got going right now is Stitches. Which is an expanded graphic novel that you did back in 1995 with our friend Todd Camp.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Now, can you describe, before we get into our show tonight, can you describe exactly what that is for those who might not know?
We created the first Stitches, the 32-page comic book, in 1995 while under the remaining direct influence of Harvey Kurtzman.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it's basically mad metastasized.
All right. I'm with you so far.
And the new edition contains a whole bunch of stuff that we were working on at the time, but left unfinished because other distractions always kick in. Mm-hmm. And I've expanded with a couple of original stories that Josh Allen Friedman and I did together.
Excellent. Josh, by the way, has a wonderful album out right now, too.
Doesn't he?
Yeah,
he's premiering it Saturday night in Dallas.
Well, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful piece of work. I love his acoustic guitar version of the theme from Shaft. It's just terrific, terrific. And I'm sure the Stitches stuff that he did is wonderful as well. And that will be probably by the time that people can hear this podcast, it'll probably be up and ready to be ordered.
It's pretty close to publication day. Yeah, Josh and I had always wanted to do a book of stories about New York elevator men.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember them from some of the early Friedman Brothers stories.
I see.
And we have never realized our ambition of doing a full book, but we got two really good stories out
there. Oh, that's great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that one too, Michael. And now I want to get in. We'll talk about our books a little bit later on. And right now I'd like to get into a film that is one of your favorites from, I don't know if it's 1955 or 1956. I've seen both dates on it. But it is a strange one. In fact, I'm not really entirely sure where to start. We usually do B-pictures on our Forgotten Horrors podcast.
Right.
This is what I believe we were talking about this the other day, and I believe this is what your friend George Turner and your collaborator George Turner called a nervous A.
Yeah. above a B movie, B standing for budget, of course.
Yes.
But certainly not in the not a film to mention in the company of some major studio top of the line downtown theater picture.
Mm-hmm.
And the the beauty of Female on the Beach, of course, is that it foreshadows Joan Crawford's emergence into what you've called the old gal school of horror.
Yes, and other more less kinder people call hagsploitation.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
But you find her in fairly advanced middle age still playing a romantic figure, and it's like, does it work? Probably not for her, But it certainly works to this film's advantage because it's got that kind of creepy has-been vibe about it.
It does. That's exactly right. And what makes it even creepier is that they keep referring to her as this beautiful lady that's taken over this house. She's 50, 51 years old probably when this was released. And I should say we're talking about a film from Universal called Female. It is Universal, right?
Oh, yes, it's Universal.
Universal called Female on the Beach, produced by a guy that a lot of us B-picture and cheap film fans love, Albert Zugsmith. Exploitation film fans, I should say.
Zugsmith had the rare privilege of heading that unit at Universal that handled some very prideful prestige pictures, handled some really good genre pictures like the Incredible Shrinking Man.
Right.
And later, thinking it was doing just another B-type picture, delivered probably one of the few real masterpieces of Orson Welles, Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil with that great tracking shot at the very beginning.
What an astonishing piece of work that is.
Well, one of the interesting things about this, I think, Michael, is that just as you see Joan Crawford, maybe this role presaging her, whatever happened to Baby Jane, Straight Jacket, mm-hmm. Trogs, all that stuff, also, this kind of presages Albert Zugsmith's sort of descent into exploitation. There are exploitation elements in this picture throughout, it seems to me.
Yes, starting with the title.
Exactly. And I looked at that. Charles Drake, who plays the lieutenant in it, who's been a reliable character actor, was for decades, picks up that big shark hook that they find on Joan Crawford's steps and says something to the effect, I wrote it down here, let's see, a lone female on the beach is kind of a target for a hook like this. There's all sorts of metaphors in it. I won't even get into Jeff Chandler's, well, I will, to get into Jeff Chandler's rebuilding the fuel pump, which is one of the great metaphors, romantic metaphors. It's a stretch, but it's a great one.
Oh, yeah. Well, we kids who would go to the drive-in movies and the downtown B theaters in school would see a picture like this and just kind of collect those lines.
Right.
The hook line is a perfect corollary to the sheriff's warning to Allison Hayes in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, where he warns her against prowling the desert. He refers to her diamond necklaces, prowling the desert with a nice piece of glass like that. And it's like, wow, did you guys catch that? And then, of course, the adolescents in the audience nudge each other.
Right.
And say,
well, there's even some metaphorical resonance here for us older folks, too, when you get into some of those. This is probably a good time to give just a brief synopsis. Joan Crawford plays an heiress, a woman who comes back after her apparently mafia ties or organized crime ties husband, who was a big wheel in Vegas, as I understand it,
mm-hmm.
has died. And one of the places she inherits is this beach house. Well, it turns out someone has just died horribly by coming off the balcony, falling off the balcony in this beach house. And that person is actually Judith Evelyn, who us monster kids remember as the mute woman in The Tingler.
That's correct.
Yes.
And the falling from high places, especially on the beach, mm-hmm. Boy, does that ever ring some bells.
And in fact,
part of what I liked as a kid about Female on the Beach was its distinct resemblance to one of Bert I. Gordon's better pictures, Tormented.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Falling with Julie Redding, falling from the lighthouse.
Right.
But, you know, in this one, so Joan Crawford, we are led to believe that Jeff Chandler, who's essentially a beach bum who can't seem to get his boat fixed, they call him Drummy, and he is hooked up with a real pair of, like, card shark, really kind of bad people, Cecil Kellaway. And then, of course, Natalie Schaefer, who was later on Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm. Yes, who both of whom are almost too lovable to be crooks, and that makes them all the creepier.
They are very creepy in this, and of course there's the romantic thing. Joan Crawford refuses Jeff Chandler, which I'm sure the audience is all pulling for her because he seems like he's no damn good. And and then it sort of unfolds, and we also have Jan Sterling in it as the real estate agent, a great film noir presence, B-picture presence, or nervous A-picture presence. And it's,
yes,
it's just got so much weird stuff in it. And
I can hear the chorus, well, it's not a horror movie. Actually, it is.
It's about as scary as a film as I've seen. And
conflicted emotions,
yes,
are more terrifying than any monster at large.
And plus, there's murder in it.
And you got homicidal, well, borderline homicidal maniacs at large.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got that Universal pedigree and the production company within Universal. I've always said that when you think you've run out of the Universal spookers, you can always turn to their film noirs and even some of their soap operas, and this one kind of straddles that barrier.
It does. It's not really, you can't really put it in any particular genre, can you?
Mm. No. It's kind of like Cross Country Cruise a few broadcasts ago.
You know, that's not a bad analogy, because it does have the elements of horror in it, the sudden elements of horror that Cross Country Cruise has.
Right.
And it also, you know, a lot of people know Joan Crawford. I know when I first really got aware of Joan Crawford, it was in those hagsploitation or those old lady films that she was making. And I think maybe the first time I encountered her was with William Castle, with Straitjacket. You know, I mean, I'm sure I'd seen Joan Crawford before that, but growing up with monsters, what I was interested in was horror films. And
yeah, I used to think she was married to that guy on Highway Patrol.
Broderick Crawford?
Joan and Broderick Crawford, you know, kind of like Eldridge and Beaver Cleaver.
Well, I suspect that they had dipsomaniac tendencies that were kind of the same. But other than that, that would have been a fun couple, wouldn't it? I can see her sitting there drinking with Broderick Crawford's bunch. What was that, like Rod Cameron and Andy Devine and some of those guys?
Yeah.
You know, that would have been quite an outfit. But Joan Crawford in here is also just a weird presence. It's like, it's almost like her not quite femme fatale, not quite old gal. Not quite. Just kind of determines the way the rest of the picture goes, like it's built around her.
It is very much built around her. She was romancing one of the big shots at Universal at the time.
Yeah, I think it was the president, wasn't it? Was he president at that time? Yeah.
Exactly. And she had leverage to have a picture built around her. She demanded Jeff Chandler, who was not really a glamour boy. He was more of an ideal face and figure for the noir type stuff.
And hadn't he really made his fame at that point by playing Cochise?
And he was
Broken Arrow and
Broken.
Mm-hmm.
And and doggone if he didn't work even better outside those. Because he had a profile that could cross ethnic boundaries.
Yes.
And he also had that prematurely white shock of hair.
Right.
He was kind of a muscle man, but he didn't look all that wholesome.
No, he did not. As a matter of fact, it's very easy to suspect him immediately, isn't it, in this picture?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of as you say, the way that he looked and the image that he projected. He was a huge star, though. Was that about the time, or did he become a bigger star later?
He died prematurely.
Yes, he did.
Right at the threshold of larger and larger breakthroughs. I've always considered him to be kind of like the prototype for Richard Gere.
That's interesting. Okay, I could see that. Sure.
He's easily accused, perhaps wrongfully, perhaps not.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back and look at the arc that Richard Gere has enjoyed over the long term, and you see those same kinds of roles. He's like, could be a heartthrob, more likely a creep.
Right. or somebody that's a combination of the two.
And somebody who's ideally suited to that moral ambiguity you see in the idiom we call film noir.
So maybe he's an A-picture Tom Neal, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh, very, sure. very good analogy there. And the kind of pictures that Zugsmith was making at Universal, including another picture he did with Zugsmith called The Tattered Dress.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tattered Dress is more of a pure film noir. But I really gravitate to those that blur the boundaries between genres and idioms.
Well, we do that a lot on this podcast. We blur a lot of genres and idioms here.
Yeah.
But you have always gone back to H.P. Lovecraft, haven't you? That's where I learned it. You're the first person who told me that. Yeah.
Horror is where you find it.
From his essay, what was the essay that he did?
Called Supernatural Horror in Literature.
That's right.
Published during the 20s in various forms. He kept revising it and kept revising it, and a preliminary version would get published, and then he'd go back and work on it some
right.
more. But all in the service of proving that argument that, no, it's not just the... It's not a Chamber of Commerce thing.
Right.
You don't wait for the sign to point you where to point your camera.
Mm-hmm.
You go in and explore the whole landscape, and you find the spooky stuff that you can appreciate.
And that's right. And the horror that comes out of this particular picture, I think, is kind of almost like in Freaks, in that it's always just off kilter. You know, like in Freaks,
mm-hmm.
in the very beginning, it's off kilter. It's not what you expect. Now, this is not that intense, but it's got a weird from the very first frame. It just doesn't seem quite right. Like it's going to click and settle down into some genre. It's just a little too like rabbity or something for that. You know?
Yeah.
Do you get that feeling with it?
I get that feeling definitely. It's that sense that not only is everything not all right, but everything's probably not going to be all right.
Right, that's right.
And Joan Crawford is such an effective actress. Accusations of vanity beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
She's such a good actress, physically, intellectually, emotionally, that you really feel her disorientation in this situation.
I think one of the really overlooked people in this picture is Judith Evelyn. We only really see her in flashbacks except at the very beginning, and she's the first woman who is the tenant of the beach house,
mm-hmm.
who is the one that, of course, dies as she goes off the railing. And then there's later on there's flashbacks with her, and she is just brilliant in it. And at some point, you start getting the feeling there's some really interesting things going on here. You get the feeling that the filmmakers want you to see Joan Crawford as going in those greased grooves just as the Judith Evelyn character did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you think, and so at some point then there gets, and again, I'll ask you, we haven't talked about this before, but there gets a kind of a gaslight quality
mm-hmm,
to
mm-hmm.
the picture where it looks as though she's being, Joan Crawford's character, I mean, is being run nuts.
Yes.
And there's so many little elements like that. Would this have been played as an A? Would this have been the top of a bill when it went out?
I believe it would have been given the A promotion, but I frankly doubt that the film buyers, the theatrical film buyers, would have lumped it into that category.
Was Joan Crawford still a name then?
Yeah, but kind of on the skids mm-hmm. as far as the industry was concerned. Life mm-hmm. is cheap in Hollywood,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
The cast, apart from her, Jeff Chandler on the way up, mm-hmm. Joan Crawford on the way out. Everybody else just good old B movie dependables.
And now how about the real estate agent? How about Jan Sterling?
Not a star by any measure, but I don't think she ever tried to be
mm-hmm.
that. Joseph Pevney was not known for his top-of-the-line pictures. He was known for making good, serviceable. Of course, I'm sure it went out as a solo attraction.
Mm-hmm. Something to fill out a double bill, is what you're saying.
I do not recall seeing. I saw it in first run, and I do not recall a double bill situation. Mm-hmm. I could be mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
That. Bees often were the bottom half of a double bill,
right.
But often they played as their own attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Paramount would occasionally put a bee out by itself, not often.
Mm-hmm.
But Joseph Pevney, who really directs this thing for like a kind of a seething. It's not an extremely violent picture, except in bursts. It is more of a brooding, ominous picture.
It's kind of a lustful picture.
Very lustful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's bubbling underneath.
The same vibe you get off of, say, a Jock Turner picture from that period called Nightfall.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. A film noir.
Very pure. Excellently well-made film noir that I really like better than Turner's picture from the same year, Night of the Demon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which is the one that gets among us fanboys that gets all of the stroke.
And of course everybody says, but Nightfall hadn't got any monsters in it. So, well, yes, it does.
Yeah, monsters are where you find them. It's just like horror, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is a little bit of a hard picture to find. Our producer, Joey Hambrick, ran it down in the TCM version. Turner Classic Movies put it out.
Oh, that's a limited edition. Yeah, they're not really limited editions. They press them to order.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know that, Joey? That they press the films to order on those TCM movies like that?
Oh,
print on demand. Then, isn't it?
That's why you can't find them on the chump change rack.
I see. No, we didn't. We spared no expense for our listeners to get this one. No chump change here, not at all. Well, and speaking of that, you know, Joey wanted me to point out that there are several ways that you can support this podcast. Joey, would you mind stepping up to the microphone and because Joey is the one that's behind this. This is Joey Hambrick, our producer here on the Forgotten Horrors podcast. Joey, I'm going to turn it over to you for a moment.
This is Associate Producer Joey Hambrick. I'd like to thank you for listening. You know, the show is free, but that doesn't mean there aren't certain costs associated with it. If you're able to, there's a few possible things that you can do to help us out. Number one is just in iTunes to subscribe or give us a star rating or leave a review if you feel so inclined. Preferably those should be positive, I would hope. Also, there's a Forgotten Horrors podcast group that you can be a member and give us possible recommendations for future shows or just tell us what you're currently, enjoying. And also, you know, first of all, I'm just a fan of John and Michael, first and foremost. I'm so in disbelief that they allow me to be a part of any sort of creative endeavor of theirs. And, you know, we do a plug segment at the end of the show, but there are a few things I would recommend as far as Amazon purchases go from both John and Michael. Any of the Forgotten Horrors books are tremendous. I find myself just flipping through them and rereading them often. They're just awesome to have on the shelves. They look great, besides the fact that the content is just unbelievable. John recently, a company called Pulp 2.0, just reprinted some of his comics from the 90s, The Twilight Avenger. They're on Volume 2. I love them so much. Once again, thank you, and back to the show.
Thank you, Joey.
Thank you, Joey.
We appreciate that, and we do want to thank people because we hear from people quite a little bit, and we're very happy with the way that the podcasts are going and the number of people that are listening to them. And so, thank you so much, anybody who's ever listened to the podcast, and of course that means you right now because you're listening to the podcast, and also if you've said anything online or bought a copy of one of our books, we appreciate that. The Forgotten Horrors books, especially.
We should also mention that Waiting in the Pipeline is a book of the Forgotten Horrors podcast collected in print.
It is Waiting in the Pipeline. That's right. And it takes a lot of transcribing, and that's what we're into right now. Yep. Also waiting in the pipeline is another collaboration between you and me, called Fantasies in the Sand.
And I can hardly wait to get that one off.
I can hardly wait to get to that one, too. But let's talk about what we do have out. And let me, if I may, I'm going to brag just for a second. This is, of course, this is coming out on the 13th of October. We're taping it earlier. And I have just had my newest book became the number one Amazon new, let's see, I can say this, on Amazon, it's the number one new baseball biography.
Yeah.
And it just came out. It's got the little banner, number one new baseball biography. We're very excited about it. It's called Ralph. It's called Right Down the Middle, The Ralph Terry Story. And I wrote it with the pitcher from the New York Yankees in the 1960s, Ralph Terry. We're both from the same hometown, Michael. That's how this all happened.
I didn't know that. That's
Chelsea,
great.
Chelsea, Oklahoma. That's right. And we're getting ready to do signings now. We're doing one for the Chelsea Alumni Association. But we're just, if you're a baseball fan, you know a baseball fan, that might be something you want to look at on Amazon. It just seems to be jumping off the shelves, and we're very excited about that. So, so how about you? What's going on?
Oh, man, we're just flailing about.
Trying to get the graphic novel we're talking
getting
about.
The, getting the new mm-hmm. edition of Stitches off to press probably tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually started laying out cover designs for a couple of the next Forgotten Horror books,
mm-hmm.
horrors books. And, man, it's like, yeah, let's just stop the merry-go-round for a few minutes.
I heard that. Well, I did love it. You know that because I wrote you about it. I did love Forgotten Horrors Volume 9. It's a terrific book.
Oh, that's the one that I filled up with some unclaimed boxes for the Salvation Army. like a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Well, that's never been reprinted before. Let's sock that in there. So it was kind of one of those books that didn't exactly write itself, but it was already written, waiting to be assembled. It's amazing how much stuff we do on the side that never gets reprinted anywhere else.
Well, you like the term piebald, I know.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's a pretty piebald book, but it's terrific fun. It's just great fun. And
well, it's a gumbo.
It is a gumbo, and you know, I've always said that I'm kind of like the packing house of journalism. Eventually, we grind up and use everything, even the horns and the hooves. And so I think you and I are both alike in that way.
Nice work if you can get it.
It is nice work if you can get it. We want to thank everybody for listening to these podcasts. We're going to have one coming up next week. We're going to jump, or next month, I should say, we're going to jump from Joan Crawford to and Female on the Beach to a true B picture or low budget picture. Not, I guess B would not be particularly correct in this case,
mm-hmm.
Called Lamora.
Yeah.
And we'll be doing that one for November the 13th, so we want to remind everybody to tune in on that. And we always love to hear from you. Please leave a message if you'd like. Like us. Can you like us on Facebook, Joey?
Yes.
You can like us on Facebook. I don't know what that means, but I've seen that phrase. So
you can also comment
and comment
on the Facebook page.
And as people have done, people have asked us to talk about certain pictures. We're always glad to do that, too, if you've got one of your favorites that's coming up. And actually, we will be back in a couple of weeks with a bonus, kind of a short podcast, aimed towards some of the Halloween films that we might suggest that you take a look at this Halloween. Till then, Michael, thank you. It's been great.
Delighted.
Talk to you soon.
Might have fun.